Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman of the Football History Dude podcast, and I'm stopping by this show real quick to tell you about a couple of cool giveaways that we have going on here at the network. Both are autographed books covering various topics of the NFL. The first is The Point After, How One Resilient Kicker Learned There Is More to Life Than the NFL by ex-NFL kicker Sean Conley. It goes over his unique experience as a walk-on kicker at the University of Pitt after never playing high school football. And then it gets into some of his time playing for NFL teams and so much more beyond the gridiron. The other is from author Kevin Bryant. His book is titled Spies on the Sidelines, The High-Stakes World of NFL Espionage. This book started as a curiosity, kind of a passion project to understand everything revolving around, well, Spygate. But this put Kevin down a rabbit hole learning about all sorts of espionage that has occurred throughout the history of the NFL. Both permissible and often the illicit techniques of gathering intel to try to impact the outcome of the game. To sign up for your chance to win an autographed copy of one of these books, all you gotta do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways and sign up. That's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. Again, check out all the other podcasts that we have on the Sports History Network as well. But now, back to your regularly scheduled journey to the sports history timeline.
Fielding H. Yost is one of the greatest coaches in college football history, and he made so many things that are part of football today that we take for granted. Well, find out more of those as we go right into the teeth of Fielding H. Yost's career and his Point of Minute teams with Dr. John Behe coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we're going to pick up in a conversation we had recently with Dr. John Behe, who wrote a great book called Coach Yost, Michigan's Tradition Maker. It's just a fantastic book on the life of football of Fielding H. Yost, the most famously the Michigan Wolverines coach and tradition maker, just like the book title says. And Dr. John Behe, as we discussed in part one of the series, if you haven't listened to that yet, please go back and listen to it. It covers a lot of Coach Yost's early career in football, playing and coaching. And we're still in the early part of his career. And our part one sort of ended with his tenure at Nebraska, that 1 year period in Nebraska. So we're going to pick up with Dr. Behe's conversation right now, just the leaving Nebraska.
Now, this is Yost. Can't do anything but brag. He goes back each time he finishes a season back to West Virginia and talks about how great they were and he was. And after finishing the season at Nebraska, he goes back and he talks to his players. The guy said, one of the guys who played next to him was coaching West Virginia. 6'4", 210-pound, wonderful athlete. And he was the other tackle in the Yost's flank for the West Virginia team. And he talks to him about how great. And the guy says, you know, I'm going to come out and play for you. Maybe I'll come out. And the Yost is thinking about, you know, well, they'll just slip in ringers every now and then. And he thought, what the heck? I got an idea. Maybe I'll run it past you, and maybe we'll do it. Well, the idea was this big guy would come out. He'd pretend he came from a small Kansas town, a country bumpkin who had no ability and no coaching. And so the guy had to act the part. And out he comes, and they play Missouri, a really good team. But before he ever gets to the game, about 2 weeks before that, one of the athletes who was playing football finds this guy. Says, "You ought to call for, most of the talent came from students. You didn't recruit talent very often anyway. Mm-hmm. That day and age, you played with whatever was on our campus." And he goes, "You ought to be out for football. You're pretty good. I mean, you're big. You'd learn it pretty fast, I bet." And so he tells the coach about it. And the fellow who helped Yost as a defense coach, line coach, was Mr. Naismith. He was their basketball coach. He's the inventor of basketball. He's on the staff there to coach basketball, but Yost puts him to work with football.
So, Dr. James Naismith. Wow, that's interesting too.
That's him. And Naismith is not in on this. He does not know what's going on about this Krebs kid. And so, in any case.
Yeah, let's make sure we say his name, because the player that's in question is that used to play with Yost is George Krebs, correct?
That's
K-R-E-B-S. Okay.
You got it. You got it. And so anyway, this was a typical thing for coaches, and they still do this some of the time. If they think a guy is pretty good, but they don't know if he has the mental toughness to stand a punishment and come back for more, they grab about three of the guys who are pretty good players, and they say, "And work him over. Let's see what he's made of." And they do. And so pretty cool. I mean, they really start pounding on him, and pretty soon Krebs then comes to life, because he's a heck of an athlete, and he starts dealing them like cards, for guy's sake. I mean, he is knocking them all around, and Yost calls off the dogs because he doesn't want to, hurt the guy or hurt the players. All right, so Krebs plays for him. And they wind up beating Missouri, and he doesn't come back to Lawrence, to Kansas, after the game. Pleads a mother dying or a death in the family. He's got to go, and he's heading back to West Virginia, is where he's going to do, never to be heard from again. Except that Westbrook Pegler, who was a sport writer, who could have been a top notch detective anywhere in the country, he decides that this thing has too much. It taints. It smells. I got to get to the bottom of this, and by gosh, he does. And he finds Krebs, and I think at that point in time he's in, might be in the Carolinas, but anyway, he finds him, and gets him to say, "Yes, it was a hoax. I came out there, pretended this as a," and so they said, and so Bog Allen is the great Bog Allen, basketball coach at Kansas, is mm-hmm. the AD. And he says, "Let's get him back here and to celebrate." And he decides he will come back. He'll come clean with them, tell them exactly what happened, and celebrate. He's getting up there in years, Krebs is, and he knows while there are no rules against what he did, it was unfair. And so he comes clean, and they celebrate his coming back. He didn't live very long after that, as I recall. But anyways, Yost get by with that now for, no one found out about that for at least 20 years. So he's done with Kansas, and but that quest to learn, to be adventuresome, was there, and he starts hunting for something out on the coast, and he talks to the boys, the Sigma Chi boys, and they say, Stanford needs a coach. And he makes the application, and of course, now he has even more people to write for him, and so he's got they are loaded with endorsements, and they hire him. Oh, as a matter of fact, the manager of football decides that he will come out to a meeting of coaches and athletic directors or whatever in the East, and he will stop and see Yost in West Virginia on his rail travel. And so now he has firsthand met him, and he wants him for sure. Kansas is just – Stanford has just hired a president who was at the Indiana University. And so this president wants to get his hands in this mix. So he decides he has a meeting he wants to go to in the East. And so he goes out that way and meets with Yost and is thoroughly impressed. So Yost makes his way then to Stanford for the 1900 football season.
Okay. So he's already been at four schools coaching. This is his fourth school in 4 years coaching.
Well, no, three. This is his fourth year. This is his fourth school. He's got Ohio Wesleyan, he's got Nebraska, he's got Kansas. Now he's at Stanford.
Right, Stanford being his fourth school. Okay, gotcha. So he's out there. He's got some some good talent out there that's sort of untapped. And I know he has a pretty good season at Stanford, but I found it really interesting that there was a player that played on a different team that sort of caught his eye during the season.
Yeah. Well, first of all, he's wanderless. He's single. He's never been to the West Coast before. He's all eyes and all ambition. The big thing, first thing they've got him doing is the freshman team. There's only one. This is like Michigan and Ohio State. There's only one game, okay? And that's Stanford versus Cal. So
okay.
He's got to get the freshman ready, and so he puts out the call and gets a very, very few turnout. He goes to the newspaper. He gets the article in the newspaper. Come on, the class ought to be out. We got a lot of good athletes here. We're going to come on and be a factor in terms of our school. Help everybody out. Help the school out. And out they come. It isn't long, and he's got about 18 freshmen out. And he is a whirling dervish. He's got things going. They're practicing and doing, making noise, everything else. They wind up with one heck of a good turnout and with a pretty darn good team. But Cal has recruited, if in their area, says San Francisco, they have recruited some really good kids. And they're just as pleased as they can be. And they know they're going to win. Now, before coming out there, the 2 years prior to that, the mayor governor of the state, I believe, gave a trophy to the team that won two games in a row, 2 years in a row, if you could win two in a row. And Cal did. And they got a wonderful trophy, maybe the first game trophy ever in college football. And I got a picture of it. Mm-hmm. Two football players, and it's on their campus still today. Anyway, so now you got to look at that. And they kicked Stanford's keister pretty soundly. So Yost is fighting that. So Yost is out there, and he knows he's got his hands full trying to get people out for the game, out for the team. He does that successfully, and then pretty soon he gets the Stanford newspaper on his side, and he gets the students on his side, and they wind up going up there to Cal in winning that game.
Wow.
It's one heck of a game. There's a very eventful thing that happens. They're playing in a park with a lot of low-income people living in that park area, and there's a factory there. And this factory is trying to remember now exactly what, but they have molten.
It's the Pacific Glassworks factory.
You got it. That's it.
Okay.
Pacific Glassworks. That's it. And they have an absolute catastrophe. First of all, they sell out the place. Now there's no room. All these kids in that area, they wouldn't have $2 to get in a game anyway, or a dollar. But you got to find something. You either climb a tree or do something. They climbed on top of that roof and just had it filled. And of course, they're not going to sit still. They're going to cheer. And those fellows inside were tending that molten glass, and the roof collapsed. Now, we don't have a PA system at the football field. There's a whole lot of noise going on, but they have no idea in the stands what it is. They think somebody must have done something, but they're making so much noise about the game itself that they can't focus on anything else outside, and there's no way of anybody to tell them that things are a mess. And the game continues on, and Stanford wins. That, I think, made a big difference to the Stanford president. He thought that's one good reason why we need to do something about football. Too big, too noisy, too out of control, and this disaster, it just should never have happened. So that's the freshman. He then has to get the varsity going. He has tremendous success with that varsity, and they play at the point you made a moment ago. They play San Jose Teachers School. It's one of those 2-year schools, where you learn to be a teacher, and they have a fellow by the name of Willie Heston, H-E-S-T-O-N, and Yost notices him and thinks, this guy is really pretty darn good. We have a hard time stopping him when we played them, and they played him twice. So in any case, but he winds up, I'm a little afield here. I'm not sure. You probably can help me out here.
Yeah, well, he gets done with the season, and I believe San Jose was playing somebody else for a title game.
Chico State for the title game. You got it. And so Yost is finished with his season. He's got time on his hands. He is a bachelor. He's a football nut, and he says, "Would you like some help?" Yes. They played to a standstill prior to this, so now they're going to break the tie. As a matter of fact, I think they played several games, not just one. Could not decide who was the champion. So Yost gets involved, and he moves Heston from a back. I think he's playing right half. And he moved him to what would be a tailback position in today's game, so he can now go right or left. They knew when he was playing the right half, he would only go either straight ahead or around to the left. Now he could go either way. And he I think they won something like 46-0. So do you remember what that score was?
It was a pretty big blow up. But this had never been done before, correct? That nobody had put a back behind directly behind the quarterback until then. This was a new innovation, new formation of a backfield, and quite successful.
But just he as a strategist, if he'd have been a great general if he'd gone to the military. Oh, I mean, he would know how to outflank you. He would know how to fake this and get you going that way. And then you're not going to beat him. And that's the way he was as a football coach. Well, now they gave him a cup at their banquet following the end of the season. So he comes, he's got all loaded with trophies and accolades, and Stanford has decided we're going to go with alumni coaches. This thing is out of the hand. We're not going to pay a coach that Yost has made. These guys are making $1,200, $1,300, $1,500. And of course, in the East, those guys are making about $2,000 to $3,000. So he's not going to do that. So we will not need you, Coach Yost. Thank you, but goodbye. So now he's looking for a job, and he thinks that he talked to three McKay guys, and they say, you know, I think Illinois might be. And so he goes to Illinois on the way back home, and they say no, but you know what? Michigan's looking. He stops, Yost does, in Illinois, and talks to the head, to the coach there, and he says, Michigan's looking. I'll take your proposal, your request, and give it to them because we're going to be in Chicago very shortly. Well, then there's Charles Baird, who was Michigan's director of football and athletics, and Baird's going to Chicago, and he gets that information.
And I bet you Illinois regretted that later, that decision.
Oh, yeah. They already had a guy. They had just hired a guy, so I think that's a part of it, too. And, we were still young enough. In terms of information flowing across the country about who's doing what, they're still young enough that I don't think that they really knew just how good he was. But they would. They're going to find out in the next 5 years. Everybody in the Midwest, they're going to find out who Billy Yost was. So anyway, he goes back and he gets the information that does the Illinois coach relays the information to Charles Baird. Charles Baird contacts Yost and says, let's talk about the terms. And so they talk, and there's nothing formal here. It's all just gentlemen's agreements and honor system. And Yost decides that he'll come to Michigan. And he sends, he keeps all the scrapbook, all the write-ups, everything else. He sends not only all the information or all the endorsements that he can get people to send, but he also sends a box of clippings that is estimated to have weighed about 50 pounds.
Wow.
So Charles Baird has some reading to do and see just what is it he has picked up here in the way of a coach for 1901 at Michigan. Just to tease people's appetites about this guy. Kind of feeling Yost. 1901. Go ahead.
But we know he's, you know, at Michigan, but he brought some interesting things to Michigan that you bring up in your book.
Okay. I'm going to do that. Let me just jump back to help people understand why the first five teams he had at Michigan were called the point-a-minute teams. 1901, they went 11-0, scored 550 points to their opponents, zero. 1902, they scored 644 points, the opponents 12, and again,
wow,
go 11-0. 1903, 565 points, the opponents six, and that six was the tie up at Minnesota. They were 11-0-1. Now they've got 33 victories and one tie. 1904, 576 points. The opponent scored 22. They go 10-0. Now they have won 43 games and tied one. Then in 1905, 495 points to the opponent's two, the fluke of safety that broke their winning streak at 56. 55 games, one loss then, but 2-0 to an undefeated Chicago team and one tie. So now he has, you can see why they were called point a minute. And he's absolutely, at that point in time, he was clearly the best college football coach ever.
Well, I would say that's pretty good record there and a lot of scoring and some good defense. Okay, so let's go back. Let's talk about that, the training table a little bit, and then I want to go back into something else you talked about right after that. But tell us a little bit what the training table was.
Okay. Now, first of all, I'd wanted to find, I said that I did my dissertation on Yost, Fielding Yost's legacy to the University of Michigan, and then I did the story of Michigan's Black Letterman, and then I did a story about a little Hudson High School football team over here in Michigan that won 72 games and set a new national record doing that. And I thought, I think I'd like to do something else. And so I did some other things with industry and had some success with that. Retired from my teaching and retired from that and decided all I'm doing is playing golf and worrying about my chipping and my putting. And I'm not leaving any footprints in the sands of time with my golf game. I need to get back to Michigan and find out what was this guy's success formula? And I did. I uncovered it. I don't think anybody else has written this. First of all, you got to have talent. I'll get to the training table here. You got to have talent. Now, he goes to, while he's at Stanford, he sees Willie Heston. And he says to him, what do you want to do here? You're going to teach? What are you going to do? He says, I want to go to law school. Well, tell you what, if you're thinking about law school, Michigan's been hard to beat. Yes, give it some thought. And that's all he said to him. That kid showed up at Michigan. He was getting ready to go back up to Oregon, where his home is, and he's at the train station, and there's a guy who's come from Toledo with a round-trip rail ticket. Toledo's about, next-door neighbor to Ann Arbor, and about 40 miles, 50 miles. And he sells that ticket to Willie Heston for a song. So Willie shows up on campus. Yost is there, in 1901, and says, well, where have you been? What's going on here? And that's how he happened to get Willie Heston to Michigan. Now, Heston, in 4 years at Michigan, because you could play 4 years of college, because this is kind of a prep school. It's kind of like going to a grammar school or something like that. In any case, so Heston plays 1901, 1905, and so he played in 43 victories in one tie. Never tasted defeat. He was voted one of the greatest backs in the first 50 years of college football history. Now that was talent search find number one. Then he has another guy out there who's his center, and he's not a good student, and so he was doing some makeup work, but he was a determined young man, and he got him to say, take a look at Michigan. And he did. So he comes to Michigan, and he becomes his center. Then he hits a fellow by the name of Dan, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right. It's M-C-G-U-G-I-N. I don't know if it's McGugan or McGuggan, but anyway. Dan McGuggan was a wonderful guard. And he's about 6 foot and 200 pounds, and that's big for a guard. And out of Iowa, and he had seen him when they were playing. When he was at Kansas, they played Iowa. It may have been Nebraska, but one of those two. They played Iowa, and so he got to know this guy. So he's coming back now from that. Coach Yost is coming back from Stanford to hit for Michigan. He's coming by rail. But he can't pass up anybody he knows. So he has to get off the train, talk to this one of the any guys, has to get off the train in Iowa and talk to Dan McGuggan. And he says, we got a great law school at Michigan, you know. McGregor says, I think I'd like to do that. All right, well, we'll put you to work if you come up. And he did. So he has three key players. Everybody else is he picked out of the student body. But he got things going with a student newspaper. He got people out, and he built a heck of a team. So the first, but he had the talent. That was his talent search. He liked that idea of having early season training. He had seen and experienced that in his second year at West Virginia as a player. And so he wanted to do that again. Michigan had already been doing that. They'd done it a couple of years before Yost got there, and they went over on not Lake Michigan, to the other side, Lake Huron. And they had a campground over there. And they go, and the water was ice cold. And the part of these guys would go through drills, you know, but they would, but it was very, it was physically important to get ready for the season, but it was mentally important too. And nobody shied away from it. And so they would jump in that darn water at the end of their drills and then run back to the cabin to try to get to keep them freezing to death. And the Michigan coaches liked that, and their athletic trainer liked that. He was a track coach also, Keen Fitzpatrick. He thought that just built a strong inner will, toughness. You're doing something nobody else has done. Yeah, you're not ordinary. You're above, you know, you're outstanding. So anyway, he did. Physical training, early season, cold swim, dips, nutrition. I've got the, trying to think what page I've got that on. I think I wrote this down somewhere. I'll find it here. I know I will. Nutrition. It's not right in front of me, but in any case, I have in the Coach Yost book, which incidentally we're selling. They're not listening to me. I got to get off my podium here and put my salesman's hat on here. If you purchase the Yost book, Coach Yost book, Michigan's Tradition Maker, the menu that they use is published there. And I saw that when I was doing the coursework for this, and I thought, you know, he's building in, Keen Fitzpatrick, he's building in not only physical training and fitness, but self-discipline, denial. Now, no alcoholic drinks, no tea, no coffee. I don't think tea or coffee would have hurt those guys at all. But just the idea, you know, a part of what we're doing here, here's the menu, here's all the things we eat. And we take care of you. We want you to have proper nutrition if we're going to make demands on you physically.
It was part of their discipline and team building is what you're saying. The coffee and the tea, like you say, is probably not hurt their nutrition, but just to make the self-sacrifice for team, it sort of bonded them together.
That's exactly it. But they took that, and that's just one time that they would do that in terms of building that part of the person's psyche.
We're going to cut in right here on Dr. Behe's conversation about Coach Yost and save that for part three of our discussion, which will be out in just a couple days here at pigskindispatch.com or your favorite podcast provider. But I wanted to let you know you can pick up Dr. John Behe's great book that he's talking about, Coach Yost, Michigan's Tradition Maker. You can go to behe.com. That's behe.com. And there is some great stores there that you can go to that they have links to right on behe.com to find Dr. John Behe's excellent book on Coach Fielding H. Yost. We'll have part three, just like I said, in 2 days from now. So stay tuned, pigskindispatch.com. Until tomorrow, everybody, have a great gridiron day.
We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's fourth and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Guardian newspaper circa 1924. But for Marla Delft, assistant editor, everything was about to change. For she was about to discover the awesome attractiveness of Row One brand retro sports paraphernalia items, thanks to Orville Mulligan, sports writer.
And there it is.
Wow, Orville, that's really the bee's knees.
Isn't it just? A poster-sized replica of the actual 1909 World Series program cover.
I can see that. But where did you get it? And where'd you get it framed?
I ordered it from the Row One website, where over 6,000 items of sports memorabilia from the 1880s to the 1990s are available for reproduction in multiple sizes and in several different materials, with over a dozen styles of frame to choose from for prints like this.
Well, I'm sure Mr. Delft would love to put up more of these in the office. But I'm equally as sure they're beyond this newspaper's budget.
Not at all, my dear Marla. See for yourself. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com/row1.
sportshistorynetwork.com/row1. Oh, my. These are good prices. Oh, and look at this stuff. Oklahoma-Nebraska football. College basketball art. Michael Jordan items.
And so it was that Marla Delft discovered the splendiferous magic of Row One sports memorabilia arts and prints. You can, too, by visiting sportshistorynetwork.com/row1. That's R-O-W number one today for access to the full Row One catalog of gallery prints and gifts like t-shirts, long-sleeve shirts, telephone cases, coffee mugs, blankets, pillows, towels, and even shower curtains. Act today for 15% discount off all prints with coupon code SHN15 and 20% off all other items with coupon code SHN20 at checkout. And keep your dial locked to the Sports History Network for the exciting chronicles of the 1920 sports world in Orville Mulligan, sports writer, coming soon.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that, Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.